From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Dear President Chandler, I hereby resign from my position as state senator from the Hampshire, Franklin, and Worcester District effective Friday, May 4th, 2018 at 5 p.m. Sincerely, Stan Rosenberg.
That's the announcement today that Senator Stan Rosenberg will resign. We'll have the latest. Also today, Republican delegates have a message for Governor Baker.
If there was no other candidate, I would have blanked it. There was absolutely no way I would have voted for Charlie Baker.
And 65 million ride-hailing trips in Massachusetts in just 1 year.
There are understandable reasons why people choose ride-hailing. It's quick, it's reliable, it's convenient. Clean.
But what are the consequences of so many more cars on the roads? Plus, the history behind Kanye West's revisionist history of slavery. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. State Senator Stan Rosenberg is resigning. In a statement today, Rosenberg said that his resignation takes effect on 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The announcement comes after yesterday's damning Senate Ethics Committee report, which found, quote, significant failures of judgment and leadership in Senator Rosenberg's role as Senate president, and said the senator, quote, knew or should have known that his then-husband, Brian Hefner, was sexually and racially harassing Senate employees. Rosenberg's statement today spoke of his sorrow and his sense of responsibility for not doing more to protect the Senate. For the latest on this story, let's turn to WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. He's on Beacon Hill right now. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
So what's the reaction there on Beacon Hill to Rosenberg's resignation?
Well, I think it's relief, although we haven't heard directly from members of the Senate because they've been holed up in a closed-door caucus on the floor below me since 11 o'clock this morning. I suspect that many of them are relieved. Many had been calling for his resignation since that report came out yesterday. Rosenberg's resignation does take the pressure off of them because now they don't have to level some sort of a sanction against him. He, as of tomorrow, is no longer a senator, so there's really not much they can do against him. He is, for all intents and purposes, will be gone. Now, with Rosenberg out of the building, they can try to move forward with the state's business, although I suspect the cloud this has caused may take a while to clear.
Yeah. So for people who are still catching up, because so much has happened in the past 24 hours, can you just, Steve, remind us of some of the key findings in that Ethics Committee report, which was released yesterday?
Sure. It found that Rosenberg didn't break any formal rules. Those are the rules that are set by the branch at the beginning of the session. However, it did say that he violated the legislature's IT policy by directing his staff to provide his husband, Brian Hefner, his password, giving Hefner access to Rosenberg's calendar and emails. It said that Rosenberg knew or should have known that Hefner had racially and sexually harassed Senate staffers and failed to address the issue adequately. The report concluded that Rosenberg failed to protect the Senate from his husband, whom he knew was disruptive, volatile, and abusive.
Yeah. You know, Steve, I actually just a minute or two ago was in contact with one of the victims in this case around Brian Hefner. And this person told me that they think that one thing that isn't being discussed enough about the conclusions of the Ethics Committee report is that the victim believes that several of the victims of Brian Hefner would not have been assaulted had Senator Rosenberg done his job, had he taken action sooner based on what Rosenberg did know about Hefner's activities. And that's just coming from, you know, from one of Hefner's victims themselves.
Yeah, reading the report, it's obvious that Stan Rosenberg was turning a blind eye to pretty much everything that Brian Hefner was doing, making excuses for him. Oh, he has some mental problems, he said. It could be because of drinking. He was always, it seemed to be making excuses for the actions of his husband, trying to downplay some of them, and ultimately they cost him his career.
Now, you know, I'm looking at the statement that Stan Rosenberg put out today, and, he does say that he deeply regrets the difficulties the situation has created and that he had hoped, though, with the conclusion of the investigation, he'd be able to focus on representing his constituents. but that he's resigning his position because he just doesn't see that as possible anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Senate was ready to basically strip him of everything if he remained a senator, or even if he was reelected in the fall and came back next year. He would be just a senator, not a chairman of any committee, not in leadership, nothing. He would just be a backbencher because of the way the Senate set up. Basically, every senator is a chairman of something. They always, and that comes with extra money and things like that. Stan Rosenberg would not get any of that. So, you know, it pretty much with the senators, I think, privately and publicly calling for him to resign, he had no choice.
Mm. In his statement, he says that he was unaware of many of the events attributed to Brian Hefner. But, you know, on the other hand, obviously he didn't do enough because now he has to resign from the Senate. He had to step down from the Senate presidency a while ago because of this terrible series of events. I just want to get your reflection, Steve, on, you know, what this means for it's a tragic end to a long career in Massachusetts state politics.
Sure.
Right. In more than 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, a legislator was telling me today that so often we compare things to a Greek tragedy, and she said this really truly is a Greek tragedy, what's happened here. Stan Rosenberg, basically everybody thought, you know, he had two things going on in his life, the Senate, which he'd been here for over 25 years, and the legislature, which he'd been here much longer, first as a state rep, and prior to that, he was a Senate staffer in John Oliver's office. Way back in the 1970s and 1980s. He is a creature of this building. And the other thing he had in his life was his husband. And, you know, both collided and he came crashing down because of it.
Mm. You know, again, at the risk of repeating myself, I'm just looking at the language that Stan Rosenberg is using in this resignation, Steve. I mean, he says, I was unaware of many of the events attributed to Brian and took steps to address those incidents that came to my attention. That does not diminish my sorrow at what reportedly transpired or my sense of responsibility for what the Ethics Committee concludes was a failure on my part. I mean, Steve, as you said, you've been following Rosenberg for a long time. Can you just remind us of the relationship that he had with Brian Hefner and why it was so vitally important to Senator Rosenberg for so long? I mean, help us explain the turning the blind eye.
Sure.
Here.
Sure. For years and years and years, Stan Rosenberg was a closeted gay man who did not pursue any relationships. He was a confirmed lifelong bachelor. Brian Hefner, around 2008, came into his life. He was assigned a temporary job in Stan Rosenberg's office. They met. They clicked. Once Brian Hefner left the office, they began a relationship. Stan Rosenberg, I think, credits Brian Hefner for bringing him out and getting him out and coming into a relationship, a personal relationship. They both were foster children. They both had a lot in common. And around 2010, 2011, Stan Rosenberg was very, very ill with cancer. And Brian Hefner stood by him. And Brian was much younger then, in his early 20s. A lot of people said, you know, in that case, someone of that age and that age difference might have run away. If you were going with somebody 37 years older and it looked like they were going to die, they would run away and just kind of ghost. Brian Hefner didn't do that. He stuck with him through that illness, and I think Stan Rosenberg really appreciated it, and it contributed to the love that he has for Brian Hefner, and didn't want to abandon him after that. And then all this came crashing down.
Crashing down, indeed. And as I said, I keep thinking of one of the victims who, again, I just spoke with just moments before the show, who said that, you know, love or not, had Senator Rosenberg done his job, based on what we see in the Ethics Committee report, this victim says some of the people who were Brian Hefner's victims may never have been assaulted. I mean, if Rosenberg had done his job. Okay, so let's just move ahead here a second, Steve, because I have some tape here from Governor Charlie Baker. Now, we know that he has said that he respects respected the opportunity to work with Stan Rosenberg for the past several years, even though obviously they didn't agree on several key issues, but that he does believe it was appropriate for Senator Rosenberg to resign. And then Governor Baker also said this on the work left to be done on Beacon Hill.
But as I've said many times, there's a lot of stuff on the legislative agenda that needs to get done between now and the end of July. And I am concerned, and I've said this before, about how much needs to get through the system over the course of the next 50 or 60 days. And I really hope that the focus from this point forward can be on making sure we deliver on the agenda for the people who put us here in the first place, which is the voters.
So tell me, how is that possible there, Steve? Because, I still feel as if all those Democratic legislators are going to have to work hard to sort of get past this, if they can.
Yes, they will, but a lot of the business, some of the business, I don't want to say it's routine, but you have the state budget. The state budget has to be done. That is a huge, huge thing that really just takes up a lot of the time in the months of May and June leading up to July 1st, which is the first day of the fiscal year. So they're going to have to buckle down on that. On the Senate side, the senator who is steering the budget, once the Senate is now about to tackle the budget, is Karen Spilka. She's the Senate Ways and Means chairwoman, but she's also locked up the votes to be the next Senate president, and that transfer is going to take place after the budget is done, presumably the end of June, the beginning of July. Now, they'll probably try to figure out what do they have on their plate, what other pieces of legislation can they salvage before they have to stop working on legislation, which would be on July 31st. So they have a month there, and during that month, the transfer of power in the Senate president's office will go from Harriet Chandler, who, while she does have the title of permanent Senate president, she's really viewed as a temporary stopgap president while this transition's taking place. Karen Spilka will assume the position of Senate president, and she will be leading the chamber from there on out. Hmm. So she can bring her influence onto things that, there's an opiate bill that the governor would like to get through and some other pieces of key legislation that they'd like to get done before they have to call it quits at the end of July.
Yeah. Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown speaking to us from the State House today about the news of Senator Stan Rosenberg announcing his resignation. Steve, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
All right, we want to take a quick look at what this means for Rosenberg's home district. So let's turn to Dan Crowley. He's managing editor of the Daily Hampshire Gazette, and he joins us from Northampton. Dan Crowley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
What's the local reaction there been over the past day?
Well, it's still sinking in, I'll tell you that. We have reporters out right now talking, fanned out, talking to constituents, and I think what we've been hearing over the last 12 to 24 hours has been sadness, disappointment, some shock. I talked with one woman today who, in passing conversation, Rosenberg came up and I said, well, he's announced he's resigning tomorrow. She was stunned to hear that. Certainly everybody out here that's tuned into this and to state politics and the legislature knows what he's been going through. There's still he still has a loyal base of support here, and what we are hearing, and we'll continue to hear more, is that what's happened here shouldn't diminish his many accomplishments over a 30-year career in the legislature. As you can imagine, that kind of longevity, he's got the connections and the relationships that he's established over the decades.
Can I just jump in here for a second,
yeah.
Dan? Because, I mean, this is yet another one of those moments where I am reminded that these stories are very complicated, right? We have, like you said, a multi-decade-long career of Stan Rosenberg in state politics, representing the district there. But the Ethics Committee report just yesterday found that in a key way, Rosenberg failed in his leadership capacity in protecting staffers in the Senate from problematic, to say the least, behavior that he knew his husband was doing. I mean, what's the reaction in the district, you know, to that part of his legacy as well?
Well, people haven't drilled down into that detail yet on that, and yes, it is the case that the report found that he failed to enforce the Senate's anti-harassment policy, and that you know, failure and judgment and leadership exacerbated and allowed Hefner's behavior to continue. That was a key finding of the report. But it's our editorial position that he's made the right decision here, because there's been enough of a breach of trust with not only his Senate colleagues, but the constituents who have routinely elected him in the district as well. So, and I think in his statement on his resignation, Stan is acknowledging that.
Yeah.
In his words.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he had already lost his presidency of the Senate, and you know, yesterday the Ethics Committee recommended that he get no leadership positions whatsoever. So his resignation did seem somewhat inevitable. Either way, his power to represent the district was severely diminished, no matter what. So I'm wondering now, you're going to have a new state senator there.
Yeah. Well, that speaks to a larger issue here, because we now have this ongoing political vacuum in the western part of the state. Northampton, as of tomorrow, will have no representation in the state house. Peter Cocott, the state rep from Northampton, died earlier this year, and that seat is vacant. And now, with Stan leaving, Northampton is sort of in a vacuum. And in addition, John Sybak is finishing after this term. Stephen Kulik from Worthington, longtime legislator, vice chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. So there's the whole power structure in Western Mass has kind of been turned on its head right now, and there's all kinds of candidates coming out of the woodwork for these seats right now, particularly the seat that Stephen Kulik held. I think there's at least 8 candidates.
Wow.
Stan has a challenger that emerged, Chelsea Klein from Northampton, and right now it's my understanding that the deadline for nomination papers was Tuesday. So she, as far as we know, is the only candidate that was able to get her papers in and get on the ballot.
Wow. All right. Well, so there's definitely a lot to then keep an eye on there in the district. Dan Crowley, managing editor for the Daily Hampshire Gazette, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
All right. So that's the latest on the resignation announcement of Senator Stan Rosenberg. We'll have definitely more about that on WBUR on All Things Considered over the course of the afternoon. But let's turn now from Beacon Hill to the governor's race, from the legislature, I should say, to the governor's race, because it's rare that an incumbent governor has to face a primary challenger. And it's even more rare when that incumbent has consistently polled as the most popular governor in America. But that is exactly what Governor Charlie Baker is likely to be facing in September, because nearly 28% of delegates in last week's Republican state convention, voted to support conservative pastor Scott Lively. He got well over the 15% threshold needed to be included on the ballot. Lively talked about at the convention about why he believes he's the candidate that best represents Massachusetts Republican values.
I'm 100% pro-life. I'm 100% pro-Second Amendment. I stand on the original intent of the Constitution. I'm 100% pro-Trump.
Now, we spoke with Lively on Monday. You can go to radioboston.org to hear that conversation. But we wanted to hear firsthand from one of the delegates who voted for Scott Lively. So let's turn to Mary Lou Daxland, president of the Massachusetts Republican Assembly and one of 626 delegates that voted for Pastor Lively. Mary Lou Daxland, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. Ask away. What do you want me to talk about, the convention or the behind the scenes, what's going on in the Mass GOP and why we have a split in the party?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So why don't you just start with why you cast your delegate vote for Scott Lively?
Okay, I'm one of the delegates that had a number of reasons why we did not vote for Charlie Baker. Number one, we don't believe the polling that he is the most popular governor in the country. I've spoken to other reporters in the last year, and they're like, yeah, they must be polling Democrats. There is such a split in the Republican Party right now in Massachusetts over the fact that Charlie Baker is running basically in more line with the Democrat platform. He then went after the conservatives on the state committee back in 2016, spent somewhere between $1.2 and $2 million to take out approximately 26 to 28 of us on the state committee. It was basically a wash. They lost some, we lost some. And it, for all that, it just caused a lot of a divide, even now wider, mm-hmm. because it's a war on the conservatives. So what you saw at the convention on this past Saturday was a, okay, Governor Baker, you're the most popular governor supposedly in the country as a Republican. We don't want you as the nominee.
Yeah. So tell me. I'm sorry. Yeah. Forgive me for. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But tell me a little bit more about. Let's take Scott Lively out of this here for just a second. But what exactly are the conservative positions or values that you think Charlie Baker isn't representing for the Massachusetts Republican Party?
Okay. Well, basically, there's a number of them, and what the issue is, he's not following our platform. I mean, the Republican National Committee voted in a platform in 2016 that is more conservative than it has been in over 50 years. He's not even coming close to that. He promised when he ran in 14, he was going to push back on Common Core. He did no such thing. He then announced he was not going to support the presidential candidate, Donald Trump. He didn't vote for him, and he's not even attempting to follow through with the president's agenda. Something that happened very close to the convention, which really outraged the conservatives, was that Vice President Pence came to Boston for a fundraiser for the RNC, and Governor Baker was too busy to greet him. That was a huge talk amongst the conservatives. They were just outraged on that. And every delegate that voted for Lively had their... you know, a lot of different hot buttons. The Common Core that got pushed aside, the way that the conservatives were treated on the state committee, the fact that he signed into law the transgender bill, the snubbing of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. the whole basket. And I think you just played Lively's, you know, really great portion of his speech at the convention. I think we pulled some people over to Lively for the mere fact he said, I'm 100% pro-Trump.
Interesting.
And I think that pulled some people over, saying Charlie Baker has done nothing but snub his nose at the sitting president. So I think that's a big deal here.
So, I hear you loud and clear that you're definitely, you and your fellow conservatives who voted for Lively are intending to send a message clearly to Governor Baker. But I'm wondering... do you actually hope that Scott Lively wins the Republican nomination? Because he is deeply, deeply conservative. A lot of people see him as quite extreme. I mean, if he becomes a Republican nominee, I'm wondering, like, his chances of winning in Massachusetts, you're probably going to end up with another Democratic governor, is what I'm saying.
Right. I see what you're saying. Personally, I hope he makes it. However... if he doesn't make it, there is still going to be a campaign to blank Charlie Baker or vote for the Democrat. And if you go to the Mass Republican Assembly website, which is mass-ra.com, you will see our Declaration of Independence from Charlie Baker. If Scott Lively loses this primary, there will still be a pushback on Governor Baker. He very narrowly won in 2014, and people are just going to blank him or vote for the Democrat. Where is the difference between us having a Republican governor that is really should be in the Democrat Party, gives the Democrats everything they want, is going, this is another thing that's got conservatives upset, and myself included, because it happened with my state Democrat senator. Charlie Baker was down at the beginning of February in Westport at a fundraiser for a Democrat state senator. He's making robocalls for Democrats. He's doing everything he can to pull those Democrat votes. And we all know as conservatives, the Democrats vote party line.
Yeah.
And I hope say yes unto death, and they just vote for the Democrat.
Mary Lou Daxon, I'm sorry to jump in again. I'm running out of time here. There's one more question I want to ask you, because I hear your reasoning and your passion loud and clear. And I guess my last question for you is, absolutely, there's a diversity of opinion within the Massachusetts Republican Party about where the party should be. I mean, that you rightly said there's been a schism there. But I'm wondering, specifically now to ask about Scott Lively himself. He is so extreme in many of his views. What I'm wondering is, if you wanted to put up a supremely viable Republican, more conservative Republican candidate against Charlie Baker, could you have found somebody else who didn't carry, how am I going to put this, a lot of the problematic baggage that Scott Lively has with him? Did you see what I'm saying?
Then we would. I know what you're saying. I mean, I hear you saying that Scott Lively is way far to the right. I understand that.
Yeah.
There are a lot
There's got to be other people in the Mass GOP who share your conservative values but aren't that far to the right, and who could really put up a concerted challenge to Governor Baker.
You mean you want me to name names if I
No, you don't have to name names, but are there?
I would have to say there are not, because the Republican Party in Massachusetts is basically been infiltrated with Democrats. So what you're going to get is a Charlie Baker kind of governor or candidate for governor. You're not going to get anybody that is even going to come close to even saying that they're pro-life or that they're against Common Core. You're going to get the same old, same old.
I see.
That's because you don't become a one-party state without the infiltration of the opposition party. And for the most purposes, I can honestly say to you, the Mass GOP, they're all Democrats at the top of the food chain.
Until
we get control of that state committee, where we can then probably get somebody that's going to be the party chair, that's going to be a little more to the conservative side, it's going to be the same old, same old.
Huh.
I mean,
Mary Lou,
we don't run anybody against other state reps, because the money's all going to the governor's race.
Well, good point, right? There's a lot of money in the governor's race. Mary Lou Daxon, president of the Massachusetts Republican Assembly, I really appreciate you coming on today. Thank you so very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Now, you knew that people are using ride-hailing services a lot, but now we know it's a lot, lot, lot. There were nearly 65 million trips taken via ride-hailing apps, according to numbers being released by the state for the first time. More than half of them, 35 million of those trips, started in the city of Boston. That's almost 100,000 per day for 2017 alone. Now, compare that to the moribund taxi industry. It completed fewer than 6 million trips in Boston last year. So behold the full glory of our great transportation revolution. With easy rides comes, though, even more congestion, deeper worries about mass transit. But it could bring smarter regional traffic planning. Maybe if the ride-hailing companies had released data on the routes their drivers are taking, but they didn't. So there is a lot to discuss here. And for a deeper look at the data, we're joined now by WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zininjor Enwemeka. Zininjor, hello again.
Hey, Meghna.
This is one of our favorite topics, ride-hailing.
Definitely.
So thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit more about what the data from the state shows.
Yeah, so it gives us a picture of what's happening with ride-hailing across Massachusetts. As you mentioned, there are a lot of rides taking place. Most of those are concentrated in urban areas, so mainly Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville, as well as vacation destinations on the Cape and Islands. But what's interesting is that the overall number of rides doesn't tell the whole picture. So some other interesting data points, for example, are the number of trips per person. So even though Boston has the most trips overall, Cambridge has a higher per person rate with almost 65 trips per person compared to 57 for Boston. You also see in the Cape and Islands was among the top 10 there with 8 18 trips per person. Another interesting data point is that the average trip lasts around 15 minutes and goes for about 4.5 miles. The fastest trips happen in central and western Massachusetts, while the slowest trips take place in more densely populated yeah. areas. No surprise there. Boston, Brookline, Cambridge, Somerville, and Everett. Also, the data showed, you know, that ride-hailing usage tends to skew towards younger people. So that's really the big picture.
Okay. You know, I'm going to switch things up here a little bit as an enjoy, because there's a lot more questions I'm going to ask you.
Yeah.
But I want to actually just bring in our other guest who's sitting right here, Chris Dempsey. Chris Dempsey, he's director at Transportation for Massachusetts. They're a transportation advocacy group here in the state. And he's former assistant secretary at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. Chris, it's good to have you back.
Great to be on with you both.
What I'm going to do is, like, Zanindra has the numbers, and I want her to walk us through them. And I just want to get your sense, your reaction to them as we heard. So all these trips, 65 million trips, a lot in Cambridge high per capita rate, a lot we see on the Cape and Islands. I mean, when you hear that big picture, what's your reaction?
It's an enormous number. That's 10 trips for every resident of Massachusetts, every man, woman, and child in Massachusetts.
But highly concentrated in greater Boston. No.
Absolutely. Yeah. Concentrated where we already have the worst congestion, as you were saying. And I think the traffic out there is soul-crushing for drivers, and it's also a real challenge for bus riders. And this is kind of shining a spotlight on that issue.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see how, like, the pieces all connect here together, because if people are taking more rides, what does that say about what's happening to the T, Zanindra?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. And it points to some other reporting that came out earlier this year. So there was a report back in February from the Metropolitan Area Planning Council, and that's a regional agency that advocates for more transit investment. And what they found was that ride-hailing, as we've been talking about, is adding to traffic in the Boston area, but people are also opting out of public transit in favor of these services. So that report found that 59% of riders said they would have used public transit, walked or biked, if ride hailing wasn't an option. So I spoke with Tim Reardon over at MAPC. He co-authored that report. Mm-hmm. So I touched base with him about this new data that came out from the state. And he says, you know, it's clear ride hailing is a great attractive option for people, but these services are really creating challenges for the MBTA.
Our report estimated that the average ride-hailing passenger results in about 35 cents of lost revenue to the MBTA. And if you add that up across all those 65 million rides, we estimate that the revenue lost to the MBTA last year was about $21.6 million as people shifted from taking the T to using ride-hailing.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And he says there's costs to the roadways, too, that, you know, if there isn't proper planning around this growth in ride hailing, you know, we'll continue to see more of these congestion issues as we've all experienced.
Those are tens of thousands of additional cars that are on the region's roadways during the morning and afternoon rush hour as people are choosing ride hailing instead of taking the T or walking or biking where they need to go.
Okay, Chris, let me just ask you here. So the other day I saw a Green Line train with a wraparound ad for Lyft. It was almost as if the T was advertising the source of, I'm not going to say its own demise, but, you know, what the thing that's really biting into it.
I've seen that train, too. And, you know, originally the TNCs were pitching the idea that they were just complementary to transit. They were making it easier for people who are transit dependent to sometimes get a ride. I think that is some of the story. So it's not all bad for transit. But as you're seeing from Tim's research that Zanindra reported on, you're also seeing a lot of these TNCs pull riders away. That's especially true, we think, in weekends and off hours, the times when the roads are less congested and maybe transit is not running as frequently. At the end of the day, during the weekday, as long as the Red Line is running okay, the fastest trip from downtown Boston to Harvard Square is going to be on the Red Line, not by vehicle, but it's these other periods of the day, and then it's the times when the train is not working well. Yesterday was a good example of that, where people are jumping in an Uber because the Red Line was just not working.
Yeah. Not working in a big way.
In a big way. Yep.
Yeah. So let me just ask you another quick question here. So there does seem to be an opportunity, though, to have the source of the challenge to the T also potentially be a source of the solution, right? I mean, I'm thinking, like, there are other cities, Chris, like Chicago, that have a much higher surcharge per ride-hailing trip. It's like 67 cents in Chicago versus 20 cents here. And a lot of that big chunk of money, or those 67 cents, is going directly to help support transit in Chicago. sounds like a good idea to me.
I think it's a great idea. It's only 20 cents in Massachusetts. It should be higher to help support transit and help support cities and towns. And I think as a trade-off there, one thing we could be doing is looking at how we allocate our street space and whether we should be allocating more to TNC vehicles. It used to be that in front of a building, you said, okay, we want a lot of parking in front of the building so people can get in
right.
and out. What if we said instead, let's have some of that parking become pick up and drop off space.
I mean, isn't Marty Walsh trying to do that?
He is, actually. Yeah. He's looking at that. And we give the mayor a lot of credit for trying to rethink some of that street space. It's an important part of the conversation as we look at the broader whole.
Yeah. So, I mean, because it would relieve all this congestion, right, that we're seeing in Indore. I mean, it seems like it gets worse and worse every year. But wasn't there also another, there's so many reports now, but wasn't there another report earlier this year from Mass Inc. that found that voters don't necessarily think that ride hailing adds to congestion?
Yeah, there was that report. And it's interesting because, you know, that the report found that voters didn't feel that ride hailing was adding to congestion, which is, you know, clearly in counter to that MAPC report. And you know, the state data that we have shows that clearly a lot of rides are happening. That Mass Inc. report also found that Massachusetts residents really want more money to fix the overall transportation system, so roads, bridges, and the T. But in that report, it was also unclear about who should pay for those improvements. So there's a bit of some split in terms of whether to have more electronic tolling. There was some opposition to a pollution fee for companies, and there was disapproval for raising tolls during peak traffic. But there is approval for lowering tolls outside rush hours. So a bit of unclear answers in terms of who should pay for this, but there's clearly a desire for more funding.
Yeah. This has always confused me, Chris. I mean, you've been following this for so long that we're living with the consequences of this transportation revolution. And, you know, as Nindra just said, like, people want more money put in the system because we know we've got to really update, modernize almost every aspect of how we move around here in Massachusetts. And yet they don't really want to pay for it.
So this is one of the eternal debates in transportation, but I think we're actually moving into a new era where we can do a better job as transportation advocates and professionals at showing people the benefits that they're getting for what they pay into the system. And so smarter tolling is a good example of that. Zeninjor brought up the data that people are interested in a discount for driving off peak. Now, that's a concept that regions around the country and around the world are using to have roads work a little better, try to pull some of those big trucks and cars off the road at rush hour to the less busy times, leaving more space for the cars and trucks that need it at rush hour. That's something that's actually pretty simple with today's technology, all electronic tolling. And it's something that we think MassDOT and other transportation entities should absolutely be testing out and trying, because today's congestion is killing our economy. The average driver in Greater Boston wastes $2,000 per year sitting in traffic. God. That's on top of their car payment and insurance and everything else.
Wow.
So there's a real cost to your wallet, a real cost to quality of life, and we're not doing enough to try out new things.
I want to ask you one. Do you want to
Yeah, you know, I think it's worth noting too that you know, we're talking about the number of ride-hailing rides that took place last year, over 65 million.
Yeah.
There are 408 million rides on public transit that took place in that same time period. So clearly, people are still using public transit, and it's still providing and fulfilling a need throughout the Commonwealth.
Very important point, right? It is still mass transit, and it's absolutely essential. And so to that point, actually, you know, there's still room for, we don't have tons of time here, but there's still room for the conversation about what would happen if the T improved its service and became a more attractive means to get around. Because I have this tweet here coming in from Andrew who says, it's much easier to pull people off public transit when public transit is broken. Why be stuck standing crushed with other people, going nowhere, sweating like a pig, smelling BO, when you could just sit in an air-conditioned car by yourself?
Andrew's exactly right. And we need to make more investments in the T to provide better service. But at the same time, getting out of transit and being in that Uber or that Lyft might feel really good individually. Collectively, it's been a real challenge and a real downside for congestion in Greater Boston, and that's where we need leadership and policy to step in.
Yeah. Well, this is a conversation that I know we're going to be having again and again and again because it's so vitally important. I'm so happy that we've got smart people to talk about it with Zanindra Nwameka, Bostonomics reporter for WBUR. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Chris Demsey, director at an advocacy group. It's an important one. It's called Transportation for Massachusetts. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Oh, Kanye. Well, honestly, it doesn't matter at all whom he supports politically, but when a person with his star power starts saying stuff like this, there's a problem.
When you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice. Like, you was there for 400 years and it's all of y'all?
That was Kanye West in a TMZ interview on Tuesday saying slavery sounds like a choice. West later clarified on Twitter, saying he was talking about being mentally enslaved, African Americans being mentally enslaved. Now, it may not be an entirely fruitful exercise to try to peer into the mind of Kanye West to understand why he said that, but I'd say it's probably much more useful to try to understand the effect that this kind of pernicious historical revisionism has on our society as a whole. So that's why I'm really glad to bring in Leah Wright-Rigurer. She is a professor of modern African-American history at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Leah Wright-Rigurer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Now, you responded on Twitter to Kanye West's comments about slavery, and you wrote that him saying slavery was a choice is, quote, an ancient argument deployed in the past and present in defense of white supremacy. So tell us about that.
Right. And, you know, that was a constructive criticism coming from a person who has been a longtime fan and was deeply concerned that history is deeply concerned with the uses and the abuses of history. So I do think that this is a kind of common sentiment that we often hear tossed about. And it's not necessarily just by celebrities, by Republicans or things like that, but that often even in casual conversations, you know, you'll hear sentiments like, well, if people had just tried harder, they could have overthrown their captors or their enslavers or something like that. The truth is that completely misses the mark and completely misses kind of the concept or the idea or the actual system and violence of slavery as an institution. Now, there are a couple of different angles to get into this. But traditionally, and for a very, very long time, and it continues to be used in this way, the idea that black people, if they had worked a little harder, if they had been mentally strong enough, could have ended slavery much sooner is actually one that is meant or designed to encourage this idea that black people are responsible for their own condition.
Well, can I just jump in here? Because, yeah. I mean, that is pretty much what West said in his the clarification that he offered on Twitter after his TMZ comment, right? Because the full thing that he tweeted was, of course I know that slaves did not get shackled and put on a boat by free will. My point is for us to have stayed in that position, even though the numbers were on our side, means that we were mentally enslaved.
Right. And so it's this idea that the opposite of this, the mentally free, that had people been strong enough, if they had had the willpower, they had had the mental fortitude, that they could have tossed off their chains and had their freedom. It ignores the reality of slavery, the institution, that peculiar institution of slavery, and the lengths that people went, that communities went, that corporations went, that slave owners went to create those communities. It also puts all onus and all responsibility on African Americans for their own condition.
Yeah.
So it suggests that, you know, if you are unequal, if you are separate, or if you are oppressed, that's your own fault. for not trying hard enough.
You know, I mean, I just want to jump in here for a second because all of a sudden I'm thinking, as you were saying, it ignores the profound legal and institutional and societal systems that were set up around enforcing slavery in the South and even in the North, right? Because I'm thinking about the Anthony Burns case right here in Massachusetts, an African-American man who arrived in Massachusetts who was forcibly returned to the South due to the Fugitive Slave Act. How much more mentally free could he have been? He was here in Massachusetts in an attempt to be free, and yet he was taken back to the South.
Right. And also, I think, suggests that African-Americans who survived slavery, who lived through slavery, who persisted in spite of slavery, are somehow less than. Right? So it's completely devoid of history. It's completely devoid of context, of substance. It's kind of almost a flippant statement, even as it suggests that it's about power. The other side of it is that it's not an accurate statement.
Right.
We know that African Americans resisted every single step of the way. That, in fact, this is one of the remarkable things about that period, and is a testament, actually, to just how invasive and how strong these institutions and the will to kind of suppress any kind of rebellion was. I mean, we know that there was violent rebellion. We know that slaves went to great lengths, escaping their captors. We know that they resisted in subversive ways, whether it be, putting something in people's food, or whether it be through something else like learning to read on your own, or, forming their own African-inspired churches or religions or practices. Mm-hmm. So there are any number of ways that African-Americans resisted in spite of slavery. But then also, too, it is enough. It is simply enough to say that slavery happened and that people experienced it. And that doesn't make them less than weak, right? Or, inferior.
Right. Can I just jump in here? Because I want to play a little bit more from the TMZ interview where Kanye West first made his comments. And this is a moment where TMZ staffer Van Lathan actually confronted Kanye West and said that he was appalled by West's remarks.
Kanye, you're entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to believe whatever you want. But there is fact and real world, real life consequence behind everything that you just said. And while you are making music and being an artist and living the life that you've earned by being a genius, the rest of us in society have to deal with these threats to our lives. We have to deal with the marginalization that has come from the 400 years of slavery that you said for our people was a choice.
Now, Leo Wright-Rigger, on the one hand, one could possibly ignore Kanye West's comments as just Kanye being kind of crazy Kanye. He's an addled celebrity, whatever. But on the other hand, do you see that there being more serious consequences for someone like Kanye West to say what he did?
So for Kanye, I think there's been an immediate, there was almost immediately after the slavery comments in particular, a backlash amongst his fan base, particularly his black fan base, who were deeply hurt, deeply upset by his comments, which felt out of touch, and also felt like they were working in working to do active harm to the positionality of African Americans who have really fought back against these kind of pernicious stereotypes of them being solely responsible for their own condition. I think one of the things that we see in this kind of pushback and this challenging of Kanye amongst a wider community and the ideas that it introduces is that African Americans are essentially saying, these are not novel or groundbreaking ideas. These are ideas that we have had hurled at us, that we have, debated within our own homes, that have been used against us for decades, longer than that, since we have arrived on this, arrived in the United States against our will. And so I think this is what all of this is really tapping into. I think the producer for TMZ really captured that sentiment and spoke to this idea of Kanye is articulating these ideas that he says, you know, either are harmless or made in love. But actually, the deep concern is that these are arguments that often are made, are often weaponizing ideas to use against African Americans.
Yeah. So we've just got just less than a minute here to go, Leah Wright Ruger. I have one last question. I'm wondering what you think the larger political consequences might be now, because last week, before Kanye West made his comments about slavery, but he was posting, you know, him wearing a "Make America Great" hat again. The president retweeted that and said Kanye West has performed a great service to the black community. What's your response to that?
So, you know, Kanye was quite defensive about the idea, has been quite defensive about the idea that he's getting attacked simply for meeting with Donald Trump. And that's not why he's getting challenged or why he's getting criticized. He has every right to meet with Donald Trump if he wants. A number of celebrities and athletes and artists and entertainers have done that across the ideological spectrum. What people are reacting to is Kanye uncritically embracing Trump and then echoing and really advancing ideas that are seen as harmful to African Americans. Yeah. That's the crux of the argument.
Well, Leah Wright Ruger is a professor of modern African American history at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also author of The Loneliness of the Black Republican: Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Leah Wright Ruger, it's always terrific to talk with you. Promise to come back sometime soon?
Oh, I promise, as long as you'll have me back.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.